From whatthethink.com, it's Conversations in Print, a podcast about the future of the print industry with some of its more interesting characters. Hi, this is Jennifer Matt from What They Think, and I'm here with Jerry Kennelly, the CEO and founder of Tweak. How you doing, Jerry?
Great, Jen.
So, Jerry, I would like to understand how you ended up with a printing press in the basement of your home.
Well, before the printing press, my mother and father were photographers, and they did news photography, they did reportage, they did weddings, first communions, and all that sort of stuff. But they started a wonderful business in the 1950s called Ken Card Postcards, where they traveled the length and breadth of Ireland in their two Volkswagen Beetles, shooting every church and shooting every town and village. And they made these real photo postcards.
Oh,
and in
okay.
the basement of our home when I was a child, there were 20 people working, producing these postcards to order on a custom basis. And the backs were printed on a Heidelberg platen.
Please tell me they weren't working three shifts at your house.
They were working at least two during the summertime. And we were, as kids, working in the dark rooms. It was traditional paper before resin-coated photographic paper. It was traditional photographic paper, and they all had to be glazed. And we spent our summers dipping postcards in fixer in rolls of postcards and polishing glazing drums. And it was all right, little sweatshop, I can tell you.
And that probably made your house smell a certain way.
Oh, the fixer went right through the house. So that was my father decided that he needed to start creating color postcards. So he went to Drupa in Germany in Dusseldorf, and he saw a Salna 225 printing, and the pictures that were being printed, SRA2 sheet of a girl holding a duck, and he thought that was amazing. So that was his logic for selecting a Salna 225. But he was a very creative man.
So the trade show thing works. When they print out a really good photograph, they sell more presses, huh?
Absolutely. It really got him. So he loved that picture, and he ordered a Salna 225, and he ordered a Polar Mora guillotine and some finishing equipment, and we took the front wall of our house away and got rid of all the photographic equipment and moved the printing equipment.
Mm. So when you say you had to take the front wall of your house, it wouldn't fit otherwise?
It wouldn't fit. We had to get a crane to bring the presses into our basement, and we spent some years sort of getting a handle on lithographic printing. My father invented a system of color separation called a TriMask, using a photographic enlarger and a vacuum plate. He couldn't afford to get the separations on at that time. It was really expensive. So he started making those postcards using his Heath Robinson color separation system. And as soon as we got that perfected, then suddenly the market for postcards dropped, because the war in Northern Ireland had a huge impact on the tourist industry, and there were no more tourists for quite a few years, and that business pretty much collapsed. So as this was happening, the town of Tralee was flooded on a couple of occasions, and our printing equipment was under 4 feet of water.
Oh my
gosh!
So
we had to take it apart and rebuild it twice, and we were pretty close to bankruptcy for a number of years, and I was still at school, working until 4 in the morning in the printing works and getting in late to school with my brother Padraig, and it was a really challenging time. So one morning in 1974, my dad came down to breakfast, and he'd been up all night and had sketched out a newspaper, and he says, "We're going to start a campaigning newspaper, and we're going to get that goddamn council to solve this flooding problem for once and for all." And the newspaper was called Kerry's Eye. It launched a couple of weeks later in March 1974, and it's still run today by my three brothers.
Oh my gosh! So your dad started a newspaper so the flooding would get fixed.
Exactly, and it was he had a great vision for it. It was color. It was only the second color newspaper in that era in Ireland. Everything else was in black and white. It was really very progressive, and it was an exciting time for us. I mean, it was our university of life as young children and teenagers.
Did your father ever work for anybody else?
He worked in the family pharmacy. He trained as a pharmacist, and his father was a pharmacist, and his two brothers and his sister were pharmacists. So he reckoned that was enough. There were enough of them there for that chemist business, and he went and set up as a photographer in 1953.
Mm. So you know the theme I have. One of the themes I have in my life is that I wish people would start picking themselves instead of doing everything in their and schooling and everything to get picked. Mm-hmm. Like, and I know you work a lot in the entrepreneurial space in Ireland. Don't you think the future is about people creating their own path and not trying to get in? Like in the US, people are obsessed with getting into top schools and then getting good grades. And then why? So you can go work for Citibank? Like, to me, that sounds like a prison sentence, but You saw at a very early age, your father just decided to do stuff and did it. Yeah, he wasn't waiting around to get picked.
No, he wasn't. And I think that's a big part of it. I mean, the program we run in Ireland is called the Junior Entrepreneur Program. We had 10,000 kids on it this year. We'll have 17,000 kids on it next year. 11 and 12-year-old children who start their own business in a classroom.
And 12-year-old, that's young. That's
this year they had 250,000 euros in sales and 159,000 euros in profit.
Wow.
So they made an investment in their own business, but they break into teams, they identify their own skills. It's really just like a real startup. And what they learn about themselves, they learn that, yes, I'm good at this. I'm good at marketing. I'm good at sales. I'm good at making stuff happen. So I think learning what I was blessed with in my life is the fact that my father threw me in the deep end with my brothers and we had to figure stuff out. So these children on our program are doing exactly the same thing. They're learning that, yes, I'm good at this. And that little bit of competence gives confidence. And I think that's where that's where people can build on, that they can understand that, you know, a lot of children don't necessarily have the self-worth that they're waiting. The only self-worth they have is by exam results and by a very narrow measurement that is applied to them. There's no measure of creativity or the other forms of intelligence that are so important in life, and can do attitude and people who make things happen and use charm and personality to make stuff happen. Yeah.
I always say that in school, you know, they wanted you to sit still, work individually, and follow directions. I was never good at any of those. So it's like I struggled because I was bored. I wanted to work as a team and I wanted to think. I didn't want to regurgitate.
Yeah.
It felt like the whole thing was, I'm going to stand up here and talk. You have to listen to me, take notes, and then tell me that again in 2 weeks. And it just didn't factor in. And I was like, what are we doing this for? And how does it relate to what I'm doing today? I learned everything I learned about business. I learned on the soccer field.
Yeah. Strategy.
Strategy. And the basketball court, because you're working as a team, you're learning from a coach, and then you're practicing, and then you have to go perform. That's so much more about business life than the classroom.
Absolutely, learning by doing. I mean, you need some of the academic stuff as well, but I guess this, you know, that's why we all work so hard at this program. We think it really is impacting children, and teachers all across Ireland that I speak to all the time tell me that what the program reveals is new and hidden talents and skills and creativity in children that they'd never seen before. It brings it out of them, and it's completely different to what they do, yet it supports the curriculum in primary school in Ireland. And that's been really rewarding, and lots of other Irish entrepreneurs are involved with my program as well, and they really get a kick out of it. They can see that they're empowering people to become themselves and to own themselves and to give themselves the choice of someday perhaps calling the shots for themselves, and know in the back of their minds that they had the success and they were 11 or 12 years of age, and that they can at some point in the future make a decision to work for themselves, to create a job for themselves. That's where enterprise starts. If you've got the competence and the confidence to actually to employ yourself, that's where a lot of great organizations start.
I heard this great interview with this gentleman was interviewing these students, and they said what's the riskiest thing about being an entrepreneur? And the students were like, well, you know, you might fail or it might not work out. And he explained very carefully that it's if you have your own business and you have 10 customers, if you lose one, there's no problem. If you have one job and you get fired, you're down to zero income. It's one of the riskiest things you can do.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll never get fired. And I think you learn every day, and you become stronger and more independent as a person, and more resilient. Yes, there are. It's not for everybody, but I think it's a really exciting way to live your life. You're getting absolutely the most out of life, and it's a great way to express yourself. I mean, I see a lot of people who are in business. They express themselves through their branding, through their service, through the way they operate. It's a lifestyle choice for people.
So you talked about creativity, and one of the stories that I know from your past is that your mother got a particularly good photograph of Charles de Gaulle, and I just want you to tell the story because it's an example that you saw as a kid of how to creatively solve things and maybe not follow all the rules in the way you solve things, but it all turned out okay.
Yeah. So it was 1969, there was a lot of trouble in France, a lot of social unrest, and Charles de Gaulle shocked everybody by coming to Ireland, to a small village called Sneem in County Kerry. And I was 9 years of age, and I used to work in the dark rooms at my parents' home, and they ran a wire photo service to people like the Associated Press in the US and to all the British and European daily newspapers. So there was a huge amount of interest in de Gaulle and his wife coming to Ireland, and my parents were working really hard to beat the international press, and they had lots of scoops. But the really big picture was in the church when de Gaulle and his wife went to church in the little church in the village of Sneem. There were no press allowed. My mother was pregnant at the time, and she put a little Canonet camera, a little half frame 35mm camera in her handbag, went into the church, and all the other photographers were there, but they didn't have their gear. They weren't allowed to bring their equipment in. And she stood up, and at the point in the mass where de Gaulle and his wife were standing, and the Irish people were sitting, they followed the French tradition. She took out the camera, shot off three or four frames at an eighth of a second, and was promptly arrested. So she was the detective walked her out of the church, and she pulled away. "Leave me go, I'm pregnant," she said, and she got back into her mini. And drove like hell back to Tralee, processed the film, and sold it exclusively to Paris Match magazine, where it got a double page spread the next week.
So they didn't try and take the camera from her.
Well, they did, but she was a pretty tough cookie, Joan Kennelly. She wasn't going to be let that one get in her way. And it was just a great example of entrepreneurship, not just in getting the picture and understanding the value of it. But negotiating, I think she sold it in a number of countries, but the first cut was Paris Match in France. Mm-hmm. And she negotiated country by country substantial amounts of money for that picture. And that's something that I learned and used in my career afterwards. It was a great lesson in how to be a great entrepreneur.
Yeah, because she didn't just get something that nobody else was able to get, but then she got all the value from it on the back end too.
Exactly.
A lot of people miss the back end.
And I think
end.
That's really important. I know a lot of great photographers, a lot of great friends of mine are photographers. They don't always get the value. They think it stops when you take the picture and you enter in awards or whatever else. They don't understand capturing the real value. And that's a great extra kick as a creative person, that you not only got it, but you got the value and you were intelligent enough to be able to extract the value from that picture.
So this leads me to the next story I want to hear. You talked about resilience as an entrepreneur, and then now we're on this topic of extracting the value. So with StockBite, you started that and you did take some venture capital money. But when you eventually sold it, the venture capitalists were not involved anymore. So tell us the part that I love is the part where you say you knew you had sort of figured this stock photography thing out. You'd figure out how to produce great photos that people wanted to use, and other people didn't believe you or wanted to stop believing you, your investors for one.
Yeah, well, I guess I you know, it, 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 I'm a great believer in the power of photography. It's a great creative pursuit, and I think it's got real power as aspirational photography in marketing and in advertising. And we were very aggressive in our manner in entering the market. I mean, first of all, we were royalty free. We were the first company to publish royalty free stock photography in Europe, one of the first three in the world back in 1996. And because we were in the pre-press business and lots of our customers were licensing stock pictures for what they believed to be a crazy amount of money, every time they licensed a picture, they would send it to us for scanning. And it was kind of insane. And they wanted to get access to pictures. They would call up a library in the UK. They might have a catalogue of some of the pictures. Mm-hmm. And the agent in the UK would sort of send them a couple of transparencies and they would pick one. A really slow and expensive process. So we said, right, well, why not let images be licensed just like software? So sell a disc of images for $400 and with 100 images on it, and they're ready to use in CMYK format. We were the first people to do that, and that was a big thing, and people were really delighted with that mm-hmm. concept. And as time went on, we measured how successful different elements of those pictures were. We measured this every single sale, single
click.
Tell
us what year was this that you started this?
1996.
The royalty free stock photography business started in the mid 90s then.
That's it. I mean, it was Photodisc in Seattle and Digital Stock in Southern California. Mm-hmm. We were the first three companies in the world in the space, and our philosophy was to get the highest possible standard of picture for our customer and having a digital form that was ready to use. Mm-hmm. And we constantly measured all of the time. We figured out, you know, in particular subjects, you know, there were gaps in the market and other people weren't filling the gaps. Or, for example, when the Spanish population in the U.S. hit a certain point, it was really important for people who wanted multi-ethnic pictures mm-hmm. To have Spanish people in those pictures, and we were one of the first people to do it, to make sure we had multi-ethnic pictures with sort of Asian, Afro-American, Caucasian, and people of Spanish descent. So it was a very obvious thing to do, but a lot of the companies were slow and old mm-hmm. and thought we were the guys who would be gone in no time. But we worked really hard at it. We applied science, we applied data science, and common sense, and we worked hard to make sure that we were delivering a great experience for our customers.
And so, tell us a little bit about how you sold StockBite.
Well, I guess it was coming up to sort of 2005, and I'd been looking at somebody sent me a broker report on Getty Images, and I was pretty stunned to see that they were valued at 38 times earnings.
Wow.
And I reckon that we had become the largest supplier of images to Getty in the royalty-free space. They were a very important, they were our biggest customer, and we were their biggest supplier of images in that creative space. And I was really worried that the fact that, you know, that if this is a bubble, bubbles only do one thing, they burst. And it was obvious enough that Getty were somewhat overvalued, and if they were overvalued, so were we. So it was time to get out before the whole thing blew up. I had no knowledge of the stock market or mergers and acquisitions, and I had no intention of ever selling my business, but it was definitely time to move. And that's what we did. So we had an auction, and Getty put in a bid. Bill Gates put in a bid, and the Jupiter Corporation put in a bid.
Mm-hmm.
One day in Southern California, I was with a senior Corbis executive who was representing Bill Gates, and he told me that, you know, Jerry, I represent the biggest checkbook in the world.
Oh my gosh.
I said, you know, if my mother heard you making that sort of boastful statement, she'd give you a very hard time. What do you think she'd say? He said, deep pockets, short hands. When it came to it, their pockets weren't that deep because they didn't quite make the cut.
Getty outbid them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit of the side of the story that you bought out your venture capitalist before that happened?
Yeah, about 18 months or 2 years before that, we had a great director on our board from the venture capital firm who really believed and was a great mentor to me in the early days. He was retiring, and a new director came on board, and she had a different point of view. She believed that we should try and sweat our assets somewhat more. And my point was, look, we've now figured out stock photography. We know it works, and we know that a lot of our earlier stuff didn't hit the mark, and we know why. And we know how to make new content that works. We understand the customers so much more because we've got all this data. And we think we need to actually put a lot more money into the business, invest in a lot more pictures, and become the leader. Instead of making 5,000 or 6,000 images a year, we need to make 5,000 or 6,000 images every month. Mm-hmm. and become the biggest producer of the highest quality images in the world. That was our vision, and she thought I was bonkers. I made her an offer, and they took it, and the business was worth a lot more. It was sold for $135 million 2 years later. And they weren't very happy, I can tell you.
No, I can imagine. They don't like to look in that rear view mirror. Oh.
No, well, that's it. I think that's the thing about entrepreneurship and about business, though, Jen. You have to believe. You have to believe in it. If you don't believe, you haven't got a chance. Mm-hmm. And yes, we all have to pivot. We get things wrong. We have to change. We have to adapt. But you really have to believe in it. You have to understand a lot of things to believe, because it can't be just blind faith. Mm-hmm. You have to understand the metrics, and you have to look at the science behind any of the businesses that we're involved in and say, right, well, is this logical? Are we doing mm-hmm. the right things for customers? Every business is tough. Every entrepreneur I know has had a hard time in their lives, and they've gone through lots of crises. But they bring it over the line because they believe in it, they understand it, and they're experts.
Mm-hmm. But I think the other added thing about that business for you is you've been passionate about photography since a very early age. So it's a business you started in the photography business, but your passion is at that core. So you understood the photographer, and you understand the person looking at the photograph too.
Absolutely. Look, I love photography. I still take pictures every day. It's a fantastic hobby. It's a form of expression. It's a form of art, and I think it's a pattern that runs right through my life. And I was really glad to learn it from my parents, who were masters, and it goes right through our family. It's a really, really, really powerful strand, and I think that passion makes it very easy. As my father always says, I never worked a day in my life.
I wanted to hear the story about, like, when you told me one time when you were early on taking photographs, you asked your father for a zoom lens, and what was his response?
Yeah, so I'd been it was a tough apprenticeship, I can tell you. When I was learning photography, he had very high standards in terms of what you captured on film, and how you processed it in the darkroom, and how you made your prints, and how you captioned the prints for the wire services and so on. He had this great concept of using one lens. He said, you know, with one lens you can do anything. With your standard lens you can do whatever you want. So I was turning up these GAA Gaelic football matches in Ireland, and covering them for both our own newspaper and for the national newspapers for our wire service. And the standard lens wasn't getting me a lot. You had to really wait for the action to come in. So I said, look, Dad, you know, I really want to get a zoom lens or a telephoto lens because I need to get closer to the action. He says, you have your zoom lens at your feet.
Get yourself a little closer.
Yeah.
So Jerry, what do you think your parents would think of the fact that we're all carrying around a high-definition camera in our back pockets?
Well, my father made before he died, it made the transition from film to digital, and he was a great fan. He was a great fan of digital, and I am too. I think it makes photography accessible, and you know, when I look at places like Flickr and Instagram today, I mean, you see the fact that there's a lot of people are really creative and some great work there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the places that the power, from a creative perspective and a content perspective, the power of the crowd really works is in photography. It's great. It's beautiful to see the perspective of so many people.
Mm-hmm.
and their creativity, because a lot of the technical stuff that I learned as a kid is irrelevant for a lot of people now, and there's a wonderful serendipitous type of photography happening. A lot of people applying their own creative skill, and I think it's fantastic. I mean, I'm a big fan of Instagram and Twitter from a photographic point of view. I think it shows such wonderful expression, and it shows the fact that when you apply all that different brain power and creativity, that you can make wonderful pictures. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of kind of what's happened and where you've come from, what over the last 2 years, do you have anything that you've totally changed your mind on? Like something you really believed and then you're like, wow, I'm really going to change my mind because I'm seeing evidence that really proves that what I thought before is not valid anymore?
I guess, from a technology point of view, it's changing all the time. You're learning all the time, mm-hmm. and it's changing all the time. I guess the concept of individual creativity, that's the one thing that's inspired me. When I look at the designs that customers have made on Tweak, for example, I mean, it's really interesting how people in different countries around the world, in France or in Spain or in Germany or in Brazil, what they do when they get a blank canvas or one of our pieces of design, what they turn it into. It's just really amazing. I mean, I'm surprised by the power of the creativity of individuals. It's really stunning. I mean, there's a lot of raw talent out there where people are putting their own personality on their brand for their business, whether it's a lawyer or a restaurant or whatever else. They're really applying themselves to their brand in a very creative way, and I think that's a beautiful thing.
That's been one of the things you've said about all the businesses you've created, is that people have a higher design skill than we give them credit for, and they deserve, every business deserves high design. And you always point to the iPhone as kind of the thing that people really appreciate, high design, when that option is given.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody wants to look down and dirty, you know, and there's not too many Nokias hanging around the place anymore. So, you know, people not only appreciate design, but are prepared to pay a premium for it. And they shouldn't necessarily have to pay a premium. But I mean, I think in terms of design for print, it's something that's really powerful. I mean, it costs the same to print bad design as it does to print good design. So it's not always appreciated. So I think there's a responsibility on the print industry to give people the opportunity to create something that's really of value. They're not selling a commodity. They're selling something that can be absolutely beautiful if there's thought put into it. And we take a lot of care with trying to do good work. And I believe in the concept of craft. I'm a craftsperson myself, and we employ great craftspeople who really try to do a good job, and that matters.
One of the things I always think of when, you know, great design matters is like when you're choosing a bottle of wine or just any packaging in a supermarket. Like, it really impacts you. I look at the stuff that I have in my kitchen and I go, how much of it is like the quality of what's in it, or what does it look like on the outside?
Absolutely. And not only the design content, but how it's printed and it's tactile, if there's a special effect on the label, all those sort of things are hugely impactful. I'm a total sucker for it myself.
So, Jerry, you have been involved a lot. I've heard quotes, you saying that you want, you know, Ireland to be an island of coders in the future. I find it interesting, this dichotomy of, you know, we all know technology is moving faster and faster. It's not going to slow down. Yet there's like this weird backlash of, when are we going to get these quote unquote manufacturing jobs back, or when are we going to? And I'm always like, none of that's coming back. Like, none of it's coming back. And what we need to do is look forward and go, you know, I heard a quote the other day that said, at some point in the U.S. history, 73% of the working people were farmers.
Yeah.
Now, those people are not unemployed. Like, when we stopped, when 3% people became farmers, the other 97% weren't sitting around going, when are we going to get to farm again?
Exactly.
They moved to the city, so they got a different job. And so how do you respond to that when you get that kind of backlash in Ireland? Because in the U.S., I think everybody's going, when are we going to get manufacturing jobs back? And I'm like, never. They're not coming back.
They're not coming. And I guess, you know, that's part of the reason that you see there's so many disenfranchised people who are, they're never going to have a chance unless they change themselves. You know, I really believe that there's opportunity for everyone. And I mean, if you've got, if you're at a high level of skill in technology today, you can live anywhere you want, because there's a lot more jobs, there's a lot more opportunity than there are skilled people. So, you know, hanging around for manufacturing, waiting for manufacturing jobs to come is just a waste of a life. And those people are disenfranchised. And, you know, I think there's very little bravery, there's very little courage from the point of view of telling people, look, you know, you're absolutely screwed unless you change yourself. It's not the government's responsibility, it's yours. And that applies in pretty much every country in the world today, that people need to take responsibility for themselves. Certainly they need help in terms of training and so on, but I mean, they do need to make the right life choices, and a lot of people don't, sadly.
Yeah, and it really comes down to, like you said, then people go, well, I need the right training. Mm. But now, like, because of the internet, like, what you want to learn and the skills you need to learn, they're all available to you. It's like access has been democratized. So the skill, like, I see my nephews and nieces coming out of school, and I'm like, you have to learn how to code. I don't care. It's the language of the future. Like, even if you're not going to be employed full time at it, you need to understand how this works. It's like speaking English.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the early lessons, when I was starting my business, I learned FileMaker Pro very early, and it really has served me well in terms of understanding databases and working with very talented software developers, as I do. That basis of what I learned writing FileMaker Pro applications has really served me well in terms of understanding how a relational database works. That's what everything is based on.
Right, and if you have that general understanding because you tried to do it, even in a simple application like that, you can now manage people that are doing it in much more complicated ways. Yeah,
absolutely, and I think that understanding is important. And in lots of places I've seen in really big, successful corporations where the leaders don't understand technology, and they get the technology departments in those companies become self-fulfilling sort of empires, and they're totally out of control. They're not fit for purpose, because the leaders don't understand, and they're threatened by technology, and they don't get under the skin of it. And I think that's really important. I mean, any leader in a business today has to understand technology and how it works, at least at a high level.
That's my dream for the print industry, is that when I go up and talk to a printer, that they can describe their software technology stack as well as they can their printing presses.
And those are the sort of printers that we're seeing that are successful, mm-hmm. who understand both the customer acquisition, the software bit, and the manufacturing. And to be honest, probably the easiest part of it today is the manufacturing.
One of my favorite topics, and you're one of my favorite people to talk to about this, is why aren't we more focused on making print easier to buy? We seem to be obsessed on making print easier to produce, and yet I keep going to these trade shows and I'm thinking, really, we need to turn and focus on making this a lot easier on the customer. And I know you have strong feelings about it too, so what's your overall thought on that?
Well, my feeling is that printers love iron in the ground. They love their toys. They're not really too interested in the front end, but the front end is where the money is made. And, you know, if you look at any other online business, for example, if you look at the likes of Amazon, anything you touch, you can buy. And that's the kind of philosophy that we're working with our customers, our online printing customers, to make it easy for the customer. They see something, they see a good price, they can buy it. For us, it's all about convenience for the customer. It's about content. And it's about value, because ultimately print is one of the most powerful means of marketing and advertising today. Mm-hmm. It's tactile and it's never been better value. So it's you know, I think we've got a really hot product here. It's just a matter of making it easy for the customer to buy.
I think that's an interesting point, because people are looking and focusing on the digital alternatives to promoting their business. Mm. And if you look at the business models on the digital alternatives, like Facebook ads and Google AdWords, print is not only affordable, it's not an auction. You're not bidding against your competitors to get space.
Absolutely, it's almost for nothing. And I think one of the problems with digital advertising as well is the fact that there's so much of it out there. There's so much of it hitting you. Whereas in reality, if you take the time to produce a nice piece of design and it's well printed. It will cost you next to nothing, and it's really powerful, and it really works. It gets attention when it's well done.
And ironically, that nice piece of design shows up at your home, and people think that you've done something special because you put it in a physical medium now. And ironically, you could have that same banner ad hit that same customer, and they're going to get annoyed by it. So it's kind of giving a different message because we're getting overloaded with the digital space.
Yeah, there's a phenomenal amount of waste, and it's almost, I find it bizarre to think that you would bid against your competitor to buy page views or to buy mindshare. That doesn't make any sense to me. It just doesn't make business sense in any way, and it's only for the benefit of those selling those ads. Yeah.
It does make really good business sense for Google. Like, good sense. They take all the money off the table on every auction. It's the most amazing business model I've ever seen, other than tolls across bridges. Those are also kind of cool. So what can we do as an industry to make print buying easier?
Well, to me, obviously, I believe in the concept of self-service design and investing in design that's ready for the customer to use. At Tweak, for example, we've invested in, we've 1.5 million pieces of design now across 130 products and in 7 languages. So a printer simply needs to plug into our API and they can do business in 7 countries pretty much overnight. So it's a really easy service to use. Mm-hmm. That content is ready to go. We've done marketing in advance for those 350 different business types that we cover. So that makes it easy in the first instance. But the people we've seen who are a success in e-commerce is those who really understand the customer acquisition model, lifetime values, upselling, cross-selling, and really understanding how their customer behaves. And that's a very sophisticated skill set that a lot of printers don't understand. Mm-hmm. And we say to people who come looking for this service, for our service, that you need to understand this if you want to make a success of it. We'll provide you with great content, but it takes a completely different skill set to market online today. It's a very competitive space. You really need to know what you're doing. Building traffic is expensive, and you need to know how to manage that customer lifetime value. And you've got to have deep pockets to start with. It's not a cheap business to enter.
Mm-hmm. And so more self-service is really been one of your models from the very beginning. So how would you respond to printers who are like, well, full service is our differentiator, and we're, that's how we help the customers, because we'll do the things for them instead of allowing them to do it themselves online?
There's certainly a case in some instances for full service, but most of us don't go to travel agents anymore. We book our flights online, we pick our seat online, we book our cars, and we do a whole lot of other stuff online today that we didn't do 20 years ago. So the customer's expectation has changed. The customer expects to be able to be in control. They want to pick the picture, they want to pick the color, they want to pick the font, they want to pick the size, they want to pick the paperweight, they want to be in control. And that's whether they're designing something off the bat in an open shop, or whether they're doing their own corporate marketing. They're smart enough, they're web savvy enough to be able to make their own decisions and take responsibility for them. So to a certain extent, what some of those printers need to do is to leave their customers do what they want. Mm-hmm. Customers demand self-service across everything online today.
Yeah, I think the biggest misnomer about full service is that if you're doing it in a manual way and it's full service, you're also taking up the customer's time, which I think is the most precious thing and the most dangerous thing to waste. Because have you met a customer who isn't busy, who isn't overwhelmed? I've never met one.
Yeah, absolutely. And those who offer the easier way, those who offer a more efficient way to do it, are going to get the business. Mm-hmm. And customers will move, and they do want convenience. Convenience is Trump's price and everything else. So that's what customers want. They want convenience, and they want control. That's really been our experience. And those who give them that are growing like gangbusters, to be honest.
I think one of the things is that we think, in our industry, we're like, oh, it's too complicated for them to do it on their own or whatever. And I was telling you earlier today is that I went to sign up for an exercise class on my mobile device, and it showed me a little picture of the exercise room. It showed me, it asked me to pick a bike, and then it, you know, it realized that I didn't have any classes in my basket already, so I needed to buy one. The last four digits of my credit card just came up right under the bike, and I had to press one button for them to take my money. And I was just astonished because I was like on my way to the class. But they made it so easy, and that wasn't a simple problem to solve, and they solved it in an elegant way, and they were able to take my money very quickly. And had I gotten frustrated at all, because you know you're always trying to avoid exercise, right? Yeah. Had I gotten frustrated at all, I probably wouldn't have gone to the class. But it was so easy, I was like, "Whoa! I just booked it. I gotta go now." So I just feel like lots of complicated things are being solved online. And print is no exception. Much more complicated things are being done in a self-service environment.
Absolutely. I think that type of frictionless buying experience that you described is really important. I mean, if you look online, Amazon are great for it. I mean, they make it really easy to buy and to keep buying. And they, you know, they're the leader in e-commerce globally, and for good reason. They understand the customer's behavior, and they give them what they want, and they do it very well.
Mm-hmm. I used to say that I hated shopping, but I can't say that anymore, because now whenever I run out of anything, I just click on Amazon and it's there in 2 days. So I guess I don't hate shopping. I just hated going to the store. That was the problem.
Yeah. I mean, one of our customers in is based in Germany. They're called Flyer Alarm. They're one of the largest online printers in Europe. They do about 15,000 orders a day, and they really do understand customer behavior. They spend a lot of time understanding what their customers want and how they behave, and constantly evolving. They've got a special team who work on the online design product with Tweak, and constantly changing, constantly experimenting. They really put the resources into it, and it does require resources. It requires smart people who understand the technology, who understand customer behavior, and who understand marketing and the payback for the business.
Mm-hmm. So Jerry, one of my new kind of mantras and things I'm thinking about every day is fall in love with the customer's problem. And so we were discussing earlier today that that you know, when I ask a printer what kind of printer they are, they drop right into what kind of manufacturing they do. They say, "I'm an offset printer, a digital printer, a flexo printer." And what I'm really looking for is, what problems are they solving for their customers? And so, you know, we've talked a lot about how to make print easier to buy, but tell me a little bit about what you think printers could do after they finish the manufacturing. What other problems could they solve for the customer after they have actually manufactured the printed product?
Well, I think you've got to put yourself look at this through the eyes of the customer. And when you look at through the eyes of the customer, you say, right, well, if somebody's buying 1,000 flyers, what are they going to do with those flyers? Are they going to have them distributed? It'd be really cool to say, right, well, we can offer a door-to-door distribution service in your local area. We can offer direct mail. You can upload your address list, and we can have them mailed at an extra cost. Because they're the things that's what makes print work. No point in a box arriving with 1,000 flyers and the next step doesn't happen, or they haven't thought about the next step. I mean, we know what's going to happen. That print needs to be consumed to generate the next order, so that print can work for the business. And we've got to make it easier for those customers to use that print and to provide those services. You know, and I think the concept as well of bundling is a great opportunity. Whenever I walk into Costco or walk into Sam's Club, I'm offered bundles of products that I might not necessarily want to buy otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we see more bundles in online print shops? Why don't we see the concept of offering the customer a deal on buying five products instead of one?
I find that I put on a film festival this summer, and I called a printer. I needed some banners. They didn't even ask me what I was doing.
Mm.
And I had five or six other print needs, because anybody knowing, like putting on a film festival, like you have a bunch of different stuff you need to get printed, but they didn't ask one question about why, what I was ordering or what I was trying to accomplish. And so there was no way they could solve any more challenges for me. They just printed the three banners that I asked for.
Yeah, and I think it's just a matter of people stepping back from the business. They're in the service business, but they're really in the retail business now. Their customers can come directly to them, and you can grow your sales by aggressively pricing at various times, by offering bundles. You know, you can sell a piece of print by just selling a voucher code. You don't have to actually physically produce it. The cost, you could, you sell it, you drive sales at a certain, in a certain cycle by making an offer, and the customer buys a voucher code and they can get it printed whatever they want. So the that's how retailers think, and I think printers need to start thinking like the great retailers of the world.
I think up until now we've been thinking as a custom manufacturing house that we only do what the customer asks for versus telling them what they should buy instead of just doing only producing exactly what they want.
Exactly, and I think the you know, printers have can get great deals on distribution, on other services, and so on. So I think they're, I think that that thinking what the customer might do with that piece of product, if it's a newsletter for a dentist, for example, why don't you let them upload the list of their patients and mail it for them and offer them a deal on it? So that's, it ties them in all the time, and it allows them to consume print in an easier, more convenient way.
So I think the biggest question is, like, our printer, do you think printers are in a position to sort of extend their value chain? Like that scenario you just described, you have to be more than a manufacturer there. You have to be, you have to be a consultant, kind of a consultative. You have to understand how to deal with data, and then you have to understand how to deal with distribution. There's a lot of printers in that space, but I think that in order for print to remain relevant, we have to extend it beyond just manufacturing. I don't think there's going to be a lot of people, unless they're, you know, huge, you know, trade printers, that are going to be pure manufacturers. I think people are going to have to diversify into these services.
It's absolutely, and I think it's really a matter of skill sets and having a team with the right mix of skill sets and finding something that will really add more value for the customer. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, you know, right across North America, there's a pretty poor offering in terms of self-service print, walk-in print, and fast turnaround. The equipment has been there for years to do it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. You can't. There's not many places in the U.S. that you can walk into to design something on site in an easy, convenient way and have it printed literally within the hour. That's no technical challenge in today's world, but it's still not offered because people aren't thinking about the customer.
Yeah, that's it's to put it in the perspective of the customer is like we get so obsessed with internally focused. And then what I always say to printers is go have somebody in your family that's not a print expert try an order from you and see what the experience is and compare it to how they shop for other things online today, because we're not keeping up with the ease of use and the convenience that is happening online in every other space.
Exactly, and sometimes it's pricing, often it's service, but I mean the customer, it's at convenience, it's content. And it's value. That's what drives the customer today. And you know, I think you can help them make a lot more buying decisions by considering how they behave, as you say, in other environments, in other online environments, and in other retail environments.
Well, Jerry, thank you for sharing. Always interesting to talk to you. And this is my official first podcast episode. And I'm just honored that you're my first guest.
It's been a real pleasure, Jen.